This is an interview between Dale Trelevin, State Historical Society of Wisconsin, and Mark Stoller, Burlington, Vermont, June 11th, 1974. Well, first of all, could you give me a brief resume of your background, Mark?
I was born in New York City in 1945, lived there until 1966. I came to Madison to do graduate work in history at the University of Wisconsin. And I was here from 1966 until the fall of 1969, at which point I left on about a 9-month research trip. I returned in May of 1970 and stayed until August of 1970, and received my PhD here in June of 1971. Since September of 1970, I've been teaching history at the University of Vermont.
Now, when you were in Madison, you were associated with something called Up Against the Wall Radio. And could you tell me when and how you first became associated with Up Against the Wall?
The origins are a bit vague in my mind. I can remember a meeting. I forget exactly how I got invited to the meeting, but in either late 1968 or early 1969, a group of us met at Joe Jackson, I believe it was on Gilman Street. Basic purpose, people who wanted some decent music on radio. There had, of course, been the tremendous upsurge in rock music through 67 and 68. But there were also people there interested in folk music, blues, a lot of people interested in jazz. I guess the bluntest way to put it is that there was nothing but garbage on Wisconsin radio, AM, the normal rot, and FM, basically Muzak. And the aim was to somehow get some sort of what we would consider serious music on the airwaves. We felt there was a great demand for it and figured we can try and do it. Out of that meeting there emerged certain facts which we could work on. It was impossible, from what we could figure out, to work through the university station. seemed to fit in with the political analysis of the university going on around the time, that the university station could not be used by students.
Did you make any overtures in that direction?
Yes.
To talk to people?
I didn't. Others did. And we were told no. We found that the university station was about as professional as the regular stations. And it was even harder to break in because some of the regular stations would at least rent us time. The university station would not.
And by university station, you mean WHA?
Yes. And we found one station willing to rent us time at a fairly decent price, WMFM. We wanted late night hours. Considering what WMFM normally played, they did not have much of a listening audience during those hours. I cannot remember the exact price, and I'd be guessing here, but I think it was around $22 an hour. And he would supply us with an engineer.
Now, he is
Mr. Fessler.
Mr. Fessler? Is that Earl Fessler?
Yes.
The owner and general manager of WMFM?
Mm-hmm.
And did you talk to him solely about price, or did you talk to him at all about content in those early discussions?
Well, again, I was not in on the discussions, but I believe it was made clear the type of music we'd be playing, folk, jazz, rock. Throughout my tenure there, he remained at least peripherally interested in what we were playing. He did listen at times, made sure we observed the federal regulations.
The FCC regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Which
identification every 30 minutes, within 2 minutes of the hour and half hour, profanity on the airwaves, et cetera, et cetera. And to raise the money for this, the title, I guess in a couple of years, people will wonder how in the world came up with a title like that, basically was from a popular slogan at the time, which simply had FM changed around to MF. Should I spell that out for the tape?
Sure,
or,
absolutely.
The battle cry in 68 was up against the wall, motherfucker. So you reverse it to FM, up against the wall, FM. Catchy. Something that people would understand what we were trying to do. And we began to collect donations. We held one or two events to raise money. We had a blues singer, for example. I think it was Albert King. We had Albert King up here for a benefit concert. We also had a benefit picnic. We sold subscriptions to students for $1 apiece. And we were able to raise enough money to get started.
Did you suggest what the name of the program was going to be to Mr. Fessler when you originated the contract?
I do not know. I really don't know. At the end of this interview, I can tell you people you can get in touch with who would know about this. I remember we were thinking of titles. We were throwing them around one night, and that one we just brainstormed in Joe's place, and this one came up, and it hit just right for everybody. I should point out now also that, in a way, though, the title masked what were to become some severe problems later on as to the exact direction of the show. What was meshing here was a belief in all types of music, jazz, folk, rock, blues, and we could split the shows up fairly well that way, but exactly how political the show was going to be was still open to question. How it was going to be run was still open to question. The organization was extremely loose. For the first couple of weeks, just day by day, see what happened. And I can date the first crisis right around, there's a mass, very big riot, the Mifflin Street one. I don't know if you might remember the date of that. That was in the spring, the big block party that
yes.
wound up on State Street.
That's the one that was busted because of the lack of a street permit.
Right. And we were doing news reporting on that, but people were flying in and out, etc. And right after that, nothing formal, but there was an insight in regard to, you know, whether there was going to be regular programming and we'll get down to serious business and plan this thing out, or just do your own thing and see how it goes. A couple of people left, and we settled down to a definite schedule of a couple of nights a week, running from about 10 in the evening to 3 in the morning. And we did have news reporting when major events would take place. For the most part, it was music. That riot I did cover from the top of the building, if I remember correctly.
Do you feel that you were trying to reach a specific kind of audience or a specific kind of person in this, in your programming? You mentioned that there was a lack of what you call decent music in Madison, which left people no option to listen. But did you have any specific kinds of people in mind that you were, who you were trying to reach?
Well, the university community, obviously, not just the students here. Also, we found there were a lot of jazz and blues lovers just in the populace of Madison in general, who weren't necessarily associated with the university. But there, I think there's a hidden question in your question. There was a sort of belief that there was a musical counterculture that was matching everything else that was going on. And we were reaching out there. It was no accident that a lot of our shows were broadcast over loudspeakers out of the Mifflin Street Co-op for the whole Mifflin Street area.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They called us up to tell us that. The Memorial Day special was one that I remember. So there was a definite attempt to reach, I don't know if university community is the right term, because I don't mean simply students. I mean the entire community around the university that would be associated with it in one way or another, counterculture, whatever you want to call it. And we also saw ourselves partially as fulfilling this need, but also partially as educational, because as I said, since we had the mixture of blues, folk, rock, and jazz, we knew that anyone listening would be into one of the types of music. Maybe we could interest them in the other types by having this constantly shifting program. The way it was eventually set up, I believe, was 2 or 3 nights a week of jazz, one of blues, one of folk and rock.
Now, you say eventually. Is that the way it began?
The way it began was chaotic. What each man on that evening wanted to play, he played. And the schedule as to who would be on that night was usually decided maybe a day in advance. At the end of a month or two, we were set into definite scheduling slots as to which shows would be done and who would be doing them.
Now, when you say man on, you're talking about the person who... Was he the only person in the station usually at the time, or was there an engineer along with him?
There was an engineer and the person doing the show. Sometimes two of us did a show together. None of us had engineering licenses at the time. One or two of us went down to Chicago to get them so we could do our own shows. I never got around to it myself. It's a lot easier if you have your own license because all the machinery is right in front of you. But we did have the engineer there. And people would pop in and out, and it depended on each individual as to whether he'd let people come in or not. Of course, you couldn't have a party going on in there. You had to have absolute silence. But usually there'd be about 3-4 people there.
Were the same people who got together and organized the station to begin with, were those essentially the same people who, at least in the beginning, were on the air?
Yes. Yes.
And I take it those you do not wish to reveal the names of those people at this interview, or?
No, I can do that. Some of them. Some I can't remember. The key people that I do remember at the beginning were Joe Jackson, Jan Rothbard, Mark Rohr, myself, Barry Chiad. And I must have an interesting Freudian block because in the first hassle, the guy who left, I can't remember his name, or the 2 or 3 guys who left. That was the core group that I remember running the opening shows. Joe himself did not go on the air. He sort of was the master of ceremonies of this whole thing. We used his shop to meet in, used his address for mail. But he never seemed to be interested in, I think he ran maybe one show. He'd pop in every once in a while. And he'd go on the air for maybe 15 minutes, half hour, an hour. But I cannot remember him running an entire show of his own.
Now, you mentioned the negative influence of the lack of decent music in Madison at that time. Was there also a positive influence, in other words, in the conceptualization of this kind of radio program? Were there models elsewhere that you drew upon?
I know there were models I drew upon. I think each of us, coming from different parts of the country, had different models. My models were WBAI in New York, and in its early days, WNEW in New York. Now, right there, you see, was the conflict. It was one of the conflicts. BAI never did quite settle in its own mind if it was basically a talk radio station or a music. It tried to combine the two. This is what we were trying to do. NEW was almost straight music. And eventually we wound up going in that direction. I don't know if there was ever a conscious decision to do that. We would throw lines in here and there about the war, etc. What we were basically doing was playing music. We'd sometimes create a political show with our music so that the words of the songs would be saying something. But the word underground, which you used, I think summed it up. At that time, it wasn't necessarily what you said, but there was a strong belief at the time that the music itself was revolutionary, just in and of itself. And I'm not saying any of these people went into it with that in mind. We basically loved music. We had our politics, too. There was no conflict between the two. And we were just going to go on and play what people wanted to hear and do what we wanted to do, as long as it stayed within the regulations of the Federal Commission.
Mark, you said the money to begin Up Against the Wall began originally from picnics being held by by people volunteering contributions. Could you tell me where the money came from to sustain the program thereafter?
The contributions worked, but it was becoming obvious that we couldn't keep asking for more and more. There was a limit, and we did want to expand. We were originally on for just a couple of nights, and there was a big argument over what to do. There was a lot of opposition to the idea of taking commercial advertising on general principle. The whole purpose, well, here again you get into the BAI concept of alternative radio. You're not responsible to any corporation or any businessman who buys the time. We felt free to do and say what we like, but at the same time it was becoming obvious that we couldn't keep on doing this. We didn't have the energy or the time to keep throwing these benefits. Would the students keep on listening? A lot of students would say, well, yeah, but you're on at such weird hours. Well, yeah, but we can't get on better hours unless we get more and more money. So it became a vicious cycle. So we compromised. And the decision was we would take advertisements. In fact, we would actively seek them, but only from the right kinds of places, i.e. head shops, sandal places, things like that, counterculture stores.
Who determined whether a place, an establishment, was the right or the wrong kind?
General consensus. It was pretty well known.
Among the announcers and the organizers?
Right, right.
And did you read the advertisements, or were they weren't canned ads or something like that?
No, we read them live while the show was going on. That was another decision. It would not be canned. We would not have them write something up. We would do it. Now, towards the very end of my stint there, that went through another change.
Now, by the end of your stint, we're talking about?
August of 69.
You had begun in?
I'd say, if my timing is correct, I'd begun in March of 69.
So from March until August of 1969.
Right.
And you were saying that in August of 69, it was beginning to change?
We were beginning to take regular, still not canned ads, we were still reading them, but we were beginning to take one or two ads from a shoe store, a regular shoe store, here and there. And I saw a fight looming. I didn't leave town because of it, I had to leave town. And when I came back, I heard all sorts of things about the split. I had gotten letters while I was in Washington and New York that there had been a big blow-up over this and related issues, and that the original group had split wide open.
Now, who would be the best source to talk to about this split? Someone who was there at the time?
I can think of three people. If you wanted to get all sides of it, then you as a historian would have to put together what actually happened. Jan Rothbart, Mark Rohr, Barry Chiad. Barry's friend was also in on it, and I cannot remember his name. Joe seemed to keep his distance from the whole thing, so I don't think he'd be a good source for this.
Was Mr. Fessler any part of this at all?
That depends on who you talk to.
I see. It would be circumstantial if you answered that question anyway, since you were not on the scene at that particular time.
Exactly.
I see. Did you have any indication as to who actually did listen to WMFM? In other words, you were trying to reach a certain kind of audience or certain kinds of people, but did you have any evidence about who actually did listen to WMFM?
From personal contacts, people would tell me, hey, that was a good show last night, or something like that. But only people who knew me, because we didn't identify ourselves. We identified ourselves by first name on the air only. So I would not be picked out walking down the street. Banjo radios, you can't be picked out walking down the street anyway. So it was only people who knew that I was doing it. There were some write-ups in the Cardinal also about the show. Fairly good, if I remember correctly. I think you can find them in Spring of 69 editions of the Cardinal.
Okay. And shall we get into the groups now, or shall we come back to that a little later, or... Because Do you feel that you played the kinds of music that, that generally would not be played on so-called establishment radio?
At that time in Madison, definitely. We were playing what New York and Chicago FM rock jazz folk stations would play. I can tell you what went on my shows. I was never much into jazz. And again, Jan would be the person to tell you that. Blues, everything under creation. Reverend Gary Davis. Albert King. B.B. King. Luther Allison. Muddy Waters. Howlin' Wolf. And I could go on and on. In the folk field, I would play Pete Seeger, Dylan, Phil Oakes, Tom Paxton, Eric Anderson. In rock, Eric Clapton, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. That, however, did get onto AM rather rapidly. We were the first group, first station to play an album. An album came in, very strange looking. And I played it and was impressed, so I put it on, and the group called themselves Chicago Transit Authority. To my knowledge, that was the first time that was ever played in Madison. And for the first couple of months, there was no competition. There was no one near what we were doing in jazz or in rock or in blues or in folk. Nothing else around. One of my friends once was coming up to visit me late at night and had no idea whether he'd find me at home or at the station, and tuned on his car FM radio and heard a folk singer named Steve Gillette, who still remains a very unknown name. He said, "There's only one man in creation who would play Steve Gillette over the radio. He's at the station."
Where did the albums come from?
Private collections at first. Then we had an arrangement worked out with Discount Records, whereby we gave them some free advertising time. And in return, they let us use any albums we wanted to. We felt they were very generous, because we know what can happen to records, even on a single playing.
Did you use them and bring them back?
Yes, we did. We used them for the evening and brought them back. The studio itself, as we got into this, we began to make contacts with the record companies. And then the companies themselves began to send us records. So there were three inputs, and I can't say one predominated over the other. I'd say it was an equal merging of the three. I know I used my collection rather heavily. In the rock groups, I left out, by the way, the biggest of all, Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, sure.
Grateful Dead. Rolling Stones. And not the Rolling Stone cuts you would hear on the AM radio either.
Did you feel under any kind of pressure at all to play a certain album?
Not to my knowledge. I can remember once the Blind Faith album came in highly touted by the record companies, and I knew the magazines had been saying this is going to be some album. And we listened to it, and it didn't sound good at all. And it wasn't. And we played a cut from it, saying that. But for the most part, when the records would come in, we'd listen to them at home or at the studio and decide right then and there whether we would play it or not. There was, if you're talking about payola-type pressure, no, none of that. I guess we were too small to even warrant it at that stage of the game.
Was there any... When an album came in, did you have to play it ahead of time to see if you needed to censor it or censor some cuts in that album because of FCC regulations?
If it came in from the record company, there were warnings on the front, not for airplay. If there were our own albums, we'd have to use our own judgment, and sometimes we snuck some things through.
About 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah. After we were sure Mr. Fessler was asleep.
Yeah, I think I personally remember one experience that occurred between 2:30 and 3 in the morning, when a certain four-letter word was used quite regularly in one of the cuts.
I have to remember, we have to keep awake at that hour, too.
but thinking of an experience like that, how many complaints did the station receive from the FCC, to your knowledge?
None.
None at all?
None at all. We broadcast the information on time, though it was quite a tongue twister at 2 in the morning to say, this is up against the wall, FM, WMFM, 104 point. And we kept being afraid of making a blooper that would get us in trouble with the commission. But no complaints. Fessler was listening during the 10 to 11 or 11 to 12 hour. And if we did something particularly outrageous at that time, he'd call up and say he wanted the whole show taped. And the engineer would do that. One time we began a show on Memorial Day or July 4th with a cut from the electric flag where Lyndon Johnson begins giving a speech and everyone starts laughing. And that didn't strike him too well, and he taped that entire show, so we stayed very mild that night. But overall, there was no trouble with FCC.
In terms of the announcers, was there any kind of consensus among the announcers in terms of their politics, or was it a fairly diverse group?
I'd say fairly diverse. We were all into, you know, the movement of, in one way or another. But within that, I think we went across the whole political realm. Good doses of just craziness and anarchy thrown in, but I don't think you could lump them politically.
Were any of the announcers black?
Yes. Joe, as I said, during the early days.
Joe Jackson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, there were one or two black announcers that were with Jan who I hadn't met before.
I see. And I think we may have touched on this before, but how were the announcers reimbursed for their time? Were they reimbursed in some fashion?
No. Again, not while I was there. That changed by the time I got back, and there was some reimbursement. But when I was doing announcing, no reimbursement at all. This was something we enjoyed doing.
In our society, when people listen to Muzak, they can be shopping for groceries or sitting in a dentist's office. You're waiting on the telephone to reach some extension in a large concern, or you can be eating dinner. And what do you think people were doing while they were listening to Up Against the Wall radio?
We thought about this quite a bit. The one thing we wanted to avoid was exactly the Muzak type of thing. And in fact, portions of the show were meant just to jolt people out of whatever they were doing, which is why we got the complaints from those who were listening to the regular WMFM when it suddenly shifted over. We would usually start with a shot, something that just knocked people off their seats to warn everyone that here we were again. For a while, we tried to program, at least on my show. I worked with Barry, and we tried to program on the basis of what are they doing now. And the normal run would be, well, it's a Friday night, it's 11 o'clock. They're probably getting stoned. All right, we'll bring them up with some very soaring music. 12 o'clock, let's plateau them out, mellow it out a bit. So you'd start out screaming through with something like Blues Project or Rolling Stones, some Cream. Then around midnight, we figure, all right, they're settling back, let's mellow it a bit. Some of the lighter, well, not lighter, but softer Jefferson Airplane. Stuff that you'd enjoy just sitting back to. 1 o'clock, getting tired. Let's give them some music for sex. 2 o'clock, they're getting ready to crash. Let's soften it. And we do it in 20-minute sets. We had no way of knowing if this was actually what was happening, and soon realized that it was probably going on largely in our own heads. And we were creating a mythical person listening to the show, doing what we would have rather been doing, perhaps. And we used to spend a lot of time doing this. I remember with Barry working on a show for days, getting the sets arranged as to how the music one should fit into the other. Never did fit because we were amateurish and there were huge gaps between the numbers. And eventually, we didn't change it. We admitted we were doing the mood that we were in. And we just played whatever mood we felt like. There was a general rule, don't freak people out at 3 o'clock in the morning by coming through with loud, screeching music. Do that earlier in the show.
You mentioned the word set. What do you mean by set?
Set would be a group of songs with no commercial break. Usually run them for 20 minutes.
The same group?
No. A collection of songs. We had two turntables to work with. So, and in a 20-minute set, if you were doing rock or folk, you could get four songs on, depending on the size of the songs. All right, let's say you decided it's about 12:30. Let's get heavy. Let's do a Dylan set. Okay? Shall we do a chronological Dylan set? You could do that. You could start out with something like The Times they Are a Change and wind up with Just Like a Rolling Stone and show the progression. Or you could get songs of his from different periods which were saying the same things. But or you could mix the artists. You could have an artist doing a Dylan song and then Dylan doing it. But the set should make some sort of musical sense. You can combine as many groups as you want, as many different types of song, but there should be some cohesion to it. Run it for 20 minutes. Take a break, tell them who you are, rap with them for a few minutes about what's going on, and then get into another set.
So in terms of individual announcers, they really not only did their own thing, but they did organize musical material and sets. In some fashion.
In a way. Well, this was a self-imposed organization to an extent. We did have to break every 30 minutes. And sometimes we'd run the sets for 30 minutes and do all our talking during the break we had to take. But it was something that we would determine ourselves the size of the set we wanted to do. When we began to take advertising, we knew we had to put a certain number of plugs in every hour. And that had an impact also. But all music, of course, has form. It's not anarchic by any stretch of the imagination. And I wouldn't say we were musicians. In history, there's a term, the historians of the writing of history, known as historiographers, and we might have been the equivalent for music. We were taking other people's music and putting it together, and there was a form that we were creating thereby.
So music is played in sets in the customary format on Up Against the Wall. But was this format ever influenced by a specific event? I know you've mentioned the Mifflin festivities one time, which definitely influenced the format. You were down there covering that particular event. Were there other events which influenced the format of Up Against the Wall?
There were special occasions. As I think I mentioned earlier, Memorial Day and July 4th, we got heavily into, at least my show, and I can only speak for my show here, since it was on both those days, got very heavily into political protest music. Phil Oaks, a lot of Phil Oaks on those nights. If something was happening, we'd make comments on it and fit the music in. An example would be, and speaking of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and put on something like Nowhere Man, or something like that. Just whatever happened to be happening would, of course, well, it took place on two levels. There'd be the conscious level and there'd be the subconscious level. Whatever had taken place that day had a large impact on the way you were thinking, and thus on what you would be playing across the airwaves. And you hope to be establishing a bond with the listener who had gone through the same things.
So in terms of the culture of the American people observing those two occasions, you were being countercultural.
Yeah, I guess you could say so.
A little later, from the time when Up Against the Wall began, another flurry of activity began, which I believe involved something called Radio Free Madison. And this took place, or this centered around radio station WIBA FM. And what can you tell me about the beginnings of that development?
Very little. This happened again while I was gone, I believe, and when I got back it was already established. There were rumors floating about that we had been the catalysts, and other people had seen that it could work. Their operation was a lot slicker than ours, a lot more professional, with the soft voice on the microphone and saying the right things. Comedians have begun to do spoofs on FM announcers. We didn't. We were fairly raucous, very amateurish, and raw. I don't know really what impact our success or failure had on them. We felt that it had some, that they could have never started if we hadn't. But I just don't know.
Had you approached Fred Gage?
Personally, no.
I guess I don't mean you personally. To your knowledge, did the organizers of Up Against the Wall approach Fred Gage in terms of securing airtime from WIBA before approaching Fessler?
I don't know. I really don't.
Okay. I think I'd like to move on to what may be termed some more highly philosophical questions that I guess have to do with musical content of the last several decades. And one of these questions I would have is that in the context of the development of rock and roll and then rock during the 50s and 60s, where do you feel that Up Against the Wall fit into all of this?
Okay, again, this would, of course, be only my own opinion, since Up Against the Wall was at least 50% jazz.
Yes.
We weren't creating anything. I think we were mirroring and putting over the airwaves what was happening in major cities already. As I said, we did have roots in the major cities. What had been going on in music? The music itself definitely went through an evolution during the 50s and 60s. And the 60s, very strong belief that the movement was expressed in the music, that the culture and the politics were inseparable. And by going on the air and just playing the music, it was almost a political act. Also the belief that revolution was fun. And it all seemed, I don't think there was ever any conscious explanation of this by any of us. It was just a feeling about it.
Was announcing fun?
To an extent, yes. It began to be a drag for me when I couldn't get the feedback. But it was a tremendous kick at first. I can remember the feeling of elation. And not just the ego kick of hearing your voice. Getting this music out and knowing that people were listening. And a bond being established.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your close association with playing albums and cuts through not only these months but through the years, if nowhere else in your own home, as a close follower of rock music and of rock and roll before that. In your estimation, who are the most influential individuals, or what groups have been most influential?
Let me first say that basically I'm folk. I got into rock through folk, so that my basic figures are going to show that. You've got to start with Black Blues, Chicago, Muddy Waters, even before that, Lightnin' Hopkins, etc., and I can go on and on and on. Getting into white music, or having white people start playing the black music and adding their own country and western to it, the kingpin there, the kingpins would have to be Bill Haley, and of course Elvis. And that dried out in the late 50s. The British brought it back strong, the Beatles, the Stones. But what really made the key difference, from my point of view, and here my prejudice comes through, was that guy from Minnesota who went by the name of Dylan. That was really the kingpin. The words, the lyrics, the whole Desolation Row aspect of it, and the influence on the Beatles and the Stones was obvious. And I think he is the man that you really have to look to see what happened to the music in the 60s. Let me leave it there.
Well, Mark, what do you feel that Up Against the Wall Radio accomplished? Not only in terms of Madison, I suppose, but the counterparts of Up Against the Wall throughout the country.
At this stage of the game, talking in 1974, I'd have to say not that much, or not as much as what was hoped for. The music did come across. I think that the whole movement worked under a series of myths in the 60s. The music at the time was revolutionary, but I think what we forgot was the whole co-optation mechanism and the ability to tame all of this. I think it has been tamed, and in the process of being tamed, as Don McLean said, it died. I no longer listen to rock that much. The new stuff, I think, is pretty awful. There was an incredible outburst of new forms, both lyrically and musically, in the 60s, and there appears to be now a retrenchment, seeing what all this has accomplished. But the fusions of folk music and jazz and rock and rhythm and blues, the experimentation with different instruments, different ways of doing things, it's calmed down now. I don't think music speaks to a group the way it did. It's become the thing to do at cocktail parties. And in that, I think, maybe its demise. I'm reminded of the last line in Easy Rider and the last line in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, "We blew it, we blew it, we blew it." As an aftermath, it sure was a lot of fun at the time.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Mark.